Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Professor Shafi Goldwasser, ACM Turing Award recipient in 2013, which is often considered the Nobel Prize of Computing. Professor Shafi Goldwasser is also a world-renowned, distinguished researcher and professor at MIT and the Weizmann Institute. Shafi, you have a lifetime of outstanding research contribution with lasting significant global impact. Thank you for sharing your considerable expertise, deep accumulated insights, and wisdom with our audience.
You're very welcome.
Shafi, when did you hear about this extraordinary honor, being this recipient, as I mentioned, is widely considered the Nobel Prize of Computing, and that is the ACM Turing Award? How did you feel at the time? What was the reaction of your colleagues and your family?
Well, I heard about it, I think it was a Friday afternoon. I actually was just about to going. My family was going for a ski trip, actually, with my colleague's family, Sylvia, which we both won the Turing Award together. And I got a call from Ravi Sethi from ACM. You know, he starts saying, "This is Ravi Sethi. I'm chairing the Turing Award committee." So I think it was kind of clear to me what was coming. But I was extremely happy that he was also. He said that Sylvia and I won the award together. Because we've worked quite a bit together, especially in the early days, and I was very happy that of course we were recognized for the work and especially the work together. And in terms of reaction from my colleagues, it was really overwhelming. I immediately heard it wasn't announced immediately, but it was announced a few weeks later. And as soon as it was announced, you know, I heard from a lot of people that were graduate students with me at the time. So we're talking many, many years ago, around 1979. Early 1980s, writing the emails, congratulating, you know, my own ex-students, my colleagues around the world, my friends, and everybody was extremely well-wishing. It just seemed like they were truly happy with us, and it was a wonderful feeling. And they gave me a party, and lots of people came from far away, and they sent anecdotes. It was full of sort of really good wishes and a lot of humor. And my family, of course, are proud. My son was already planning what to do with the prize money right away.
So, Shafi, how would the Turing Award impact your work, your influence, and your thinking?
How would it affect my work? I'm not sure it really will affect my work. I've received some awards in the past, and I'm not sure they had sort of a direct impact on how I do research. In some sense, that will continue the way it was. I assume that it will affect my influence on directions of computer science and particular theoretical computer science. Maybe in some sense it does allow one to go and work on more open-ended research and without concern. And I certainly will feel more confident giving my students the kind of advice I've always given them, but more so that they should work on risky projects, that they should think about sort of general problems while they're trying to solve a problem that was posed by other people. Because in a sense, that's what the award is for. That's the kind of work we did, which has been awarded.
And expanding further from that, what are your life goals you want to achieve, and how will you achieve them?
I feel like I've achieved some of my life goals already. But this is not going to change, really, my passion for sort of science and the kind of problems I've been working on. I will still continue to work on it. I still hope that I have some important work to do. In terms of other life goals, as a young child, I didn't necessarily want to do computer science, didn't even know what it was. I wanted to write. I wanted to be a writer. Maybe I'll have more time to do that later on. So that's something about writing, communicating is important to me, and I think that will definitely be in my future, sort of having impact through writing rather than just doing research in the confines of my office.
Well, now I'll ask some questions about your work that led to the Turing Award and then your work after receiving the Turing Award, or I should say your current research. Now, what led you to co-write one of the most influential papers in computing science as a graduate student? And the second part of that is, what were your thought processes in introducing the question, what is the secret?
In hindsight, everything looks very different. So I tried to sort of put myself back in 1983, kind of tell you what it was about. So I was a graduate student at Berkeley. There was many courses that were offered on different areas of theoretical computer science. One of them was a course by Manuel Blum, who was my advisor and also Sylvia's advisor. And the course was on what's called computational number theory. So problems in number theory, such as, you know, factoring integers or testing whether a number is a prime or not and many other problems, but from an algorithmic point of view. You'd like to not just know whether a number is a prime or not, but you actually want to devise an algorithm to tell whether a number is a prime or to factor integers. And throughout this course, you know, I loved the material. And at the end of the course, he asked, he told us about the RSA algorithm, you know, for public key encryption. And he asked the question, how would you toss a coin over the telephone? So if there are two people without a, not sitting in the same room with a coin, but they're sitting in different places, and they'd like to toss a coin, and each one wants to win. So I win if it's heads, you win if it's tails. How do we do that? And somehow this question about sort of the combination of randomness and interaction between two people and how to leverage number theory or the complexity of number theory problems like factoring integers in order to emulate this kind of simultaneous coin toss, even though we sit remotely in a remote system, this whole combination of how you could utilize all these ingredients to solve a very real problem. I mean, not real problem in the sense that it, at the time it seemed to have impact on computer systems, but it's a real life problem. We want to toss a coin. How do we do it? It was a very exciting question. And from that point on, I was really sold on that this is the area I wanted to work on. You know, somehow the combination of number theory to solve real life problems. And indeed, the next problem that we talked about, that we worked on, this is together with Silvio, and which turned into this probabilistic encryption paper, was the question of how to play a game over a computer network. Or over a phone line, if you like. So there's several players, and they want to play, let's say, a card game. I think, let's say, what we call mental poker, or what was called in the literature then mental poker. So there is no physical deck of cards, but you want to emulate the idea that there is a deck of cards, and there are some rules to the game involving a shuffle, a random shuffle, dealing cards, and so forth. And you want to do that without a physical deck. How do you do it? How do you do it maintaining the rules of the game? So there was a protocol around, but the protocol that was around, it wasn't the right way to do it because you could find out some information about your opponent's card. And of course, in a card game, that would mean everything. So if you knew that your opponent has a high card and you have, or the deck has a high card, you would choose that one rather than a low card and so forth. So what we were looking for is a way to encode cards, the name of a card, so that you would leak no information. And that led sort of the question of how would you encode a single bit? So say you just wanted to encode whether the bit is 0 or 1. So that had to be a complete departure from sort of the ideas of the public key encryption of RSA because that one is very targeted to encrypting long information, right? So if the information is long, there's some chance that if you look at the encryption of it, you wouldn't discover what it was. But it doesn't work if what you're encrypting is, let's say, a single bit, especially because every time you encrypt in the older schemes, you would get the same encryption. So the same information would come up as the same encryption. But here, if you want to encrypt a single bit, a zero, and you want to encrypt it many times, every time it should come out and look differently. So you won't be able to recognize that you're encrypting the same bit. So we needed sort of a very different idea, and we came up with it, and which was a sort of a way to encrypt single bits, and it was a randomized method, hence the name probabilistic encryption. So every time you encrypt a bit, it looks different. But, of course, you know, there is some key or some secret that if you know that secret, you could tell what is the encryption of the bit. So all the encryptions of zeros, you'll be able to realize if you knew the secret that they were encrypting zeros and all the encryptions of ones encrypting ones. So that's an answer to your first part of the question, which is what led us to write this probabilistic encryption paper. And that was really working on this game and thinking about how to encode cards and realizing that in that context, it's very important that you want a different encryption method. The kind that hides all partial information, the kind where you encrypt the information twice, it looks completely different. You can't even identify the same encryption as being, the same information as being encrypted. And I think the second part of your question was, what were we thinking when we introduced the question, what's the secret, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So, I don't think we really introduced the question, what's the secret? I think it's more like, how would you define a secrecy. And I think if you put the question as what were the thought process, I think the main thing to is that we consider this question from a computational point of view. So in other words, how to define secrecy from a computational point of view. So what's a secret? You know, we have some intuitive understanding of what's a secret, right? something that you can't predict, maybe, or and so forth. But if you think about it from a computational point of view, you need a definition. And the definition would, you know, you could sort of brainstorm. What do you mean? You mean maybe that you can't come up with a secret. If I, let's say I have a secret X, and I'm challenging you, and you're, let's say, a computationally bounded machine, let's say you have only linear time, or polynomial time, or a limited amount of time, and I ask you to try to predict X, maybe you won't be able to come up with all of it. That would be one definition, right? Another definition is you won't be able to come up with any, but that definition doesn't rule out that you might be able to come up with half of X, but not all of X. So another definition would be you cannot predict even any bit of X with better than 50-50 probability. Another definition, but that, does, again, doesn't necessarily rule out the fact that you might find out what the some function of all the bits are, even if you can't predict one individually. So the next definition would be that there is no function of X that you can predict better than, you know, if you didn't, if X was a random string. See what I'm saying? So for any function, you can't find out F, you can't find out what F of X is. And this already leads us to the definition of a secret, that in a sense, there is no information on X that you can find better than, with no negligible probability, better than you could have computed that information on a random string, which is, you know, completely uncorrelated with X.
Can you provide details behind your approach to the simulation paradigm?
Yeah, so when people say the simulation paradigm, they I think they mean two things. The simulation paradigm is a method, it's a proof method, and it's also a definition. But so let me explain a little bit. Suppose you want to argue the security of some system, let's say an encryption system or digital signature scheme or any or more generally a cryptographic system. The cryptographic system usually has some functionality to it and some security. So what do I mean by functionality? If it's an encryption scheme, you want to make sure that you can encrypt, and if you have a key, you can decrypt. And the decryption, if you encrypted M, then when you decrypt it, you know, the ciphertext, or the, let's say the ciphertext is let's denoted by the letter C, and that's the encryption of a message M. So you certainly want to be the case, so when you decrypt C, you get M back. But what if, so that's called correctness or functionality of the system. But when you, that's one part that has to be true, and the second part is that this thing has to be secure. So how would you define security? There might be lots of definitions, but where would simulation come, how would you prove security? So one way to prove security is to say, look, whatever the enemy could have come up, when the enemy sees this encryption of the message, in some sense, you want to say that this is not adding anything new. This is not enhancing his computational abilities in any way. And the way to say that, how would you prove that? So a way to prove that is to show that all information that he has seen now, okay, he could have simulated on his own. So there's nothing new that is being added. And therefore, okay, if by seeing this information he can now, you know, break some hard problem, then he could have broken this hard problem to begin with. So let me try one more time. When we talk about modern cryptography, we almost always talk about a reduction. So if we say that this is a secure encryption scheme or a secure signature scheme or a secure protocol, we usually mean that if you could break it, where break has some precise definition depending on what you're doing, encryption or digital signatures or whatever, but if you could break it, then you could solve some hard mathematical problem, like factoring integers or some other problem. And therefore, we're saying it's secure, because if you don't believe that this factoring problem or some other problem that you base your system on is easy to solve, then it must be that your system was secure. So how would you prove such a thing? Somehow you want to say that you want to show that if there was an attacker against the scheme, you could turn it into a factoring algorithm, say if the hard problem that your system was based on was factoring. So so in order to complete that proof, you have to say that if there's an attacker, then there's a factoring algorithm. So now you have to sort of, so somebody says, yeah, you know, I have an attack, okay. And in order to utilize that to have a factoring algorithm, you have to sort of simulate everything that attacker sees in order to launch his attack. So you have to sort of simulate everything he sees during the lifetime of the cryptographic system so he can apply his attack and then factor integers. So hopefully that's not so complicated. In any case, so what I've described now as the simulation paradigm is how you prove security by simulation. But simulation paradigm has become not only just a way to prove theorems, but actually a way to define security. So what do I mean by that? So suppose you have, you want to define security. How would you define it by simulation? You could say that whatever the adversary sees during the operation of the system, okay, is something he could have simulated. regulated on his own. In that case, the system is secure. That would be a definition. So what's good about that is that instead of listing a whole long list of properties that you want from the system in order to define it as secure, it's just one definition. He says, if he could simulate what he saw during the operation of the system on his own, okay, then it's secure. And that would imply all this, any long list of properties that you want, because it's in a sense saying that he didn't need to see the real operation of the system. He could have done it on his own. So if he, you know, so that it's useless for him to see the real operation. It's much better if I had, you know, was describing to you a particular application and how simulation is defined in that context. But I think that's beyond the scope of the interview.
How did your work lead to the construction of a secure encryption scheme?
I think that in some sense we talked about that, but maybe I can sort of emphasize the construction part rather than the definition part. So we talked about, you know, that we were working on this mental poker problem, and part of solving it was to come up with a way to encrypt single bits. So even though we started from the context of mental poker, we ended up actually with a method that had nothing to do with poker for encrypting information. And if you think about encrypting single bits, every piece of information can be described as a sequence of bits, and you can encrypt each one of these bits individually. So say that it was 0000, you encrypt each zero individually, and the result, the encryption would be essentially the concatenation of those encryptions. Now, you know, I could talk about how actually we do encrypt single bits, but I don't think that's what you're asking. You're asking how it led to it. So it led to it that by the way of coming up with a mental poker protocol, we actually hit on a way to encrypt bits. And that is a in a way that was extremely secure, in a way that satisfied the property that no partial information was leaked.
Can you describe your notions of encryption security, for example, semantic security and indistinguishability, and how these measures must be met for schemes to provide security across the wide range of cryptographic applications?
Okay, so these are two different definitions, but they turn out to be equivalent to each other. So the definition of indistinguishability, what that means is that your scheme has to satisfy the following property, that even though if someone is presented, in fact, you can think of it as a game. So I have a scheme, okay, and you claim, I claim that my scheme satisfies this indistinguishability measure. What that means is that you being an enemy, no enemy can find two messages so that they can give to me two messages, say, and they challenge me. They say, here are two messages. I think we can distinguish between encryptions of those two messages. And I say to them, really? Okay, so I take those two messages, message one and message two. I encrypt the message one and I encrypt message two. As I mentioned earlier, it's a randomized encryption scheme. So when I encrypt M1, each time I encrypt it, it's a different encryption. I encrypt M2. Now I give him these two encryptions, and I ask him, hey, distinguish between them. And if he cannot tell better, so I give it in random order, right? He doesn't know which one is the encryption of M1, which one is the encryption of M2. And and now he tries to guess which is which. And if he fails, essentially, he can do no better than 50, you know, half, because he can always toss a coin and it'd be correct with probability half. But if he can do no better than a half by some, except for a negligible amount of, a negligible probability, then we say, this scheme is indistinguishable, satisfies indistinguishability, because you can't tell two messages apart, okay? Now, semantic security doesn't talk about distinguishing two messages, but it talks about that for any function that you can, if I give you the ciphertext, the encryption of M, then for all possible functions defined on M, you cannot compute those functions on the message better than you could have before you saw the ciphertext. So again, there's no difference between your ability, if I think in my head of some message M, okay, but I don't tell you and you don't see anything about it, it's just in my head. And then I give you the encryption of M. And now you look at it, you try to guess something about M, some partial information about M. So we capture that mathematically as a function of M. And, if it's the case that you cannot compute this, any partial information on M better than when you see the encryption or when it's just in my head, so it doesn't help you to see the encryption, then we say the scheme is semantically secure. So these definitions sound different, but they are equivalent. And why does that provide security across a wide range of cryptographic application? Is because, again, it says that if you use this kind of encryption, then it's indistinguishable to, let's say if you think about the indistinguishability definition, regardless of whether you've put in there encryption of M1 or encryption of M2, since since there's no way to distinguish, there would be no way to distinguish it even in the context of plugging it into a cryptographic application. And therefore, in a sense, it's like a, it's like an opaque envelope. You know, you really can't tell apart its contents. Regardless of what two different contents may be, you can't tell that apart. And therefore, even in the context of an application, you wouldn't be able to tell that apart.
Now, overall, how did your work revolutionize the study of cryptography and lay the foundation for the theory of cryptographic security?
So, you know, it's much easier to, in the sense of excitement, it's much more exciting to talk about constructions, right? You can encrypt in a way that's very secure. You can have identification protocols. You can have multi-party protocols, things which we'll probably talk about later in the conversation. But in order to do all that, you really need new notions and a new theory, or what you call foundation. That is, you have to define things like secrecy is, which we already talked about. You have to talk about other things that come up with is you have to talk about what we call in this a randomness or pseudo-randomness. You have to talk about knowledge, about fairness. So all of these are notions which existed, you know, let's say in the context of information theory. People talk about information. They talk about uniform distribution as a way to describe random events. They talk about perfect secrecy. You know, so even an information theoretic adversary, essentially cannot learn anything from an information theoretic point of view of a secret. But what we needed to do is to sort of convert all of these, even though we didn't necessarily think about it as conversions, we sort of came up with it. And then maybe later on realize that there are some analogs to this in information theoretic literature. But what you need to do is come up with all these notions with respect to an adversary who runs in a bounded amount of time. So rather than being an information theoretic adversary, it's a bounded time adversary. But with respect to this bounded time adversary, all these notions have to create a new life. And that is what the foundation of theory of cryptographic security is. So let me just give you one more example. So we talk about secrecy and randomness, or at least I just mentioned it in passing. But for example, here's another thing that has a very natural interpretation in the real world, but you need to have a definition if you want to use it in a protocol. And that is, if you and I are sitting in a room and we toss a coin, then there's or we both sign a contract, if you like, at the same time. There's some notion of simultaneity, right? I'm signing it if and only if you are signing it. But if we're over the phone and we want to sign a contract or toss a coin, we don't know. It's in what sense is that happening at the same time? After all, I do something and I send you the information and then it's your turn. And how do we enforce the fact that this information should be happening at the same time? Or I'm not going to send you, let's say, the contract signed unless you send it to me. So we have to somehow define simultaneity in a different way than the physical world. So we have to capture some sort of mathematical definition for it. And that's another thing we do, and it's part of the foundation of the theory of cryptography.
Can you talk about your work with knowledge complexity, zero knowledge proofs?
Yeah, sure. So zero knowledge proofs, if you think about it, consists of two things. So first of all, we call it zero knowledge interactive proof. And that's very important because it's not a proof in the classical sense of the world, but it's what we call an interactive proof. So zero-knowledge interactive proofs have two parts, right? There is an interactive proof and there's a zero-knowledge part. So let's maybe talk about interactive proofs first. So when we talk about classical proofs, we always talk about, implicitly, right? If there's a proof in a mathematical textbook, there's someone who wrote the proof, and then there's the audience who's reading the proof. So we want to think, let's make that explicit and call the person who actually came up with the proof the prover, and the person who's reading the proof the verifier. So why do I say verifier? Is that usually you think of yourself as reading a proof because you want to learn mathematics, but I'd like to think about your job as the reader of a proof is actually to check that the proof is correct. So there's the prover and there's the verifier. The prover's work is harder, right? He came up with the proof, and the verifier's work should be easier because he's just having to check it for correctness. So usually in a classical proof, right, in a textbook proof, the prover comes up with the proof. It might have taken him a long time, but then he writes it down, and then quickly you should be able to verify it. But let's generalize this concept and have the prover and the verifier not just talk sort of one way where the prover writes and the verifier reads, but talk back and forth. The prover sends a message to the verifier, a message meaning he writes some sort of lines of proof, if you like, and then the verifier says, well, I have a question now. He writes it. The prover answers the questions, and back and forth. So we can think of it as an interaction. And in fact, for making this interaction meaningful, the verifier, when he asks the questions, he doesn't always ask the same questions. Because if he did, in a sense, the prover could have anticipated in advance all the questions and written down the answers in a book. To make this more interesting than the book type of proofs, the verifier is actually tossing in coins, and he's asking his different questions each time. So they are randomized. Of course, they depend on what's being claimed, but they're different each time. And depending on this question, the prover should give the right answer and so forth. And at the end, the verifier says, you know what, I accept this proof is correct. This is a new method, this interactive proof. It involves interaction. It involves randomness. The verifier tosses coins to answer the question. And at the end, though, just like in a real proof, you say, I believe this proof or I don't believe this proof, okay? What we require from such a system are two things. What do you require from usual proofs? First of all, that it's possible, you know, you say that a proof system or a way to prove theorems is complete if you can, in fact, using the way you, your language of proving, which in this case is this interactive proofs methodology, you could prove correct theorem. That's called completeness. That's one thing you want to require. And the second is that somehow this doesn't, whatever mechanism you're using doesn't allow you to prove incorrect theorem, so incorrect statement. And that's called soundness. So completeness means you can prove correct statements. Soundness means you cannot prove incorrect statements. So our requirement from an interactive proof is we require completeness. So you can go, the prover can go back and forth with his question mechanism. At the end, he will convince the verifier to accept correct statements, correct proofs. But if the prover has actually a bug in the proof or he's proving an incorrect statement, okay, then we want that throughout this interactive process, the verifier at the end will reject, but we relax that requirement a little bit. We are requiring the verifier to reject with very, very high probability. So remember, the verifier is tossing coins. So there's some probability space that's being defined here. At the end, we want with very high probability he's going to reject an incorrect proof. And this is where there's a departure from a classical proof, right? So a classical proof, you say the proof is either correct or incorrect. Here we're saying in this interactive process, with very high probability, you will accept a correct proof, and with extremely low probability, you will accept an incorrect proof. But there is that small probability that you might accept as a verifier something which is wrong, okay? However, with overwhelming probability, you will reject something that's wrong. Okay, so this describes the interactive proof part. Now, it turns out that this interactive proof setting, you can prove a lot more theorems than you could have like writing down in a book. But going back to your question, another reason why it's very interesting, why we originally started thinking about these interactive proofs, was that in this way, it is possible to show that the verifier at the end could be convinced of the correctness of correct theorems, could not, you know, with overwhelming probability, will reject incorrect proofs or incorrect statements. And yet, he learns nothing else, which we call a zero knowledge. So at the end, even though he's only convinced when he should be, he himself, in particular, cannot, for example, prove the theorem to anyone else. So he has not gained the ability now to be a prover himself, but he has gotten convinced that there is a proof. So again, it's kind of weird because usually when you think about mathematics and proofs, you're trying to teach someone something. So you want them to learn the proof. In the context of cryptography, you want to convince the parties of correctness of statements, but you don't want to let them know anything else. So you want them to believe you, but you don't want to give them any extra information. So hence the zero knowledge term. And this interactive proof mechanism allows you to do so.
I'm looking at our discussion so far, and you got into some of the basis of your work and some of the underlying theories and so on, and how you came to where you are today. So let's broaden before we go back to drilling down more technically, and that is, what are the implications of this work, and how does it extend to other domains, and how does it impact us when we do things on the Internet?
So in many ways, I guess there are two ways to think about it. One way to think about this work as enabling secure communication in the sense of privacy, in the sense of being able to say, in the Internet all the time we are trying to, let's say, access Amazon or some account that we have, and we need to be identified. And one of the things about being identified over the Internet is really being identified over an insecure channel. So everybody can see our questions and answers and the way that we try to identify ourselves. So you've got to make sure that even though they can watch all these, that it doesn't teach them how to identify themselves. And it's very highly related to the idea of zero knowledge. So for identification. But more generally than that, a lot of this work has led led to what's called the multi-party secure protocol, which means it's a way for people who are sitting everywhere in distributed locations, say over the internet, to, and each one has an input of their own. Let's say I have my password and my private medical data and personal information. You have yours, and everybody else has their own. And let's say still we would like to compute something that's a function of all our private data. So compute something might be some statistics about some, that involves our medical information, but I don't want to tell you what my medical information. It might be if we are a sequence of banks that would like to, and we each make investments, but we don't want to tell each other what our investment policy, what our portfolios are. We still would like to know whether the global economy is at risk for risk analysis without telling each other what our strategies are. All of these are examples of computations which we would like to do on private data without revealing the data. And the work we've done enables that. So we enable not only to protect the privacy of communication between two people over the internet, but actually to compute on this information, okay, some highly non-trivial computations on this information, even though the information lies in the hands of different parties or different places in the internet, in such a way that at the end you are assured that the information was computed correctly, even though you weren't able to see the information of the other people. So we can compute it on data without revealing it. And that has, you know, wide-reaching applications. Some of them are not utilized. Most of them are not utilized yet. But it really enables, looking forward in the future, us to communicate better. So using the internet as a platform for further communication, further interaction without risk. So today, of course, we use the internet. We're all extremely excited. We can use the web. We can browse. It's fantastic. But, you know, we're still in a stage where we are actually finding information. We're not so much computing on it, sort of in a distributed way. And we would like to do that. But we have to realize that once we are starting to talk to other people and communicate and compute on our information together, we are at immediate risk of revealing it. And some cases, many cases, we do not want to reveal it. And this whole theory will enable that. So we will enable much greater interaction without risk and collaboration.
What is the impact of your work on computational complexity?
On computational complexity. So in some sense, you know, a few years ago I gave a talk, some invited talk somewhere, and I titled it Cryptography and Complexity Theory, A Match Made in Heaven. So I really think it is a match made in heaven. So there has been a lot of transfer over from cryptography to complexity theory. So to begin with, okay, if we sort of unwind, we go back earlier in our conversation, I was saying that almost all the work in cryptography sort of relies on the existence of hard problems, so complex problems, problems that come from complexity theory, like the difficulty of inverting or solving some hard problem, like factoring or some other problem on graphs or whatever. So that's where cryptography gets from complexity, but it's also given back quite a bit. So there are some notions that have come up in the cryptography that have become kind of the bread and butter of a lot of theory of cryptography, a theory of complexity theory research. So for example, so the two kind of very compelling examples are interactive proofs, okay, and pseudorandomness. So let's start with proofs. So as I said, interactive proofs are this mechanism of going back and forth, which allows a small probability of error, but kind of enlarges the way that we use to do proofs. So you can study that from a complexity point of view, and people have, and it's given us completely new ways to prove theorems and to classify, actually, traditional complexity classes, like polynomial time or polynomial space. And these are very traditional complexity notions, which have been studied now from this new perspective. Another thing that happened is that once people realized that there are different ways to prove theorems, they said, well, maybe that's not the only way. Maybe instead of talking about interactive proofs, we can think of other ways to prove theorems. So, for example, you know, when how about that the prover, okay, is not just sending messages back and forth with the verifier, but let's think about another setting where in a sense, a proof is happening. What's the setting? So, say two people are being accused of a crime by the police. Then the usual thing that you think of is that they have an alibi, right? And the police wants to interrogate them and to break down this alibi. So he takes these two suspects, put them in separate rooms, or these various suspects, and then he goes and asks questions from each one and trying to sort of see if their alibi is consistent. So if you think what's happening here, you could imagine of thinking of these people sitting in different rooms as all provers. So they've come up with a proof of a theorem. And now the verifier is coming, and he wants to interrogate them to figure out if the proof is correct. So and how is he going to do that? By putting them in separate rooms, in some sense, he's going to check to see if there are holes in the proof. He's going to ask one question from one suspect, then he goes and asks a question from the other suspect, and back and forth. And this mechanism means that he might just find a hole in the proof by checking the consistency of their answer. So that gives a whole new proof system, right? What we call multi-prover interactive proof. So again, obviously you don't think of the two mathematicians are going to sit in this two different rooms and someone's going to come interrogating them, but over the internet you can think of that. So you're trying to prove a statement and someone is trying to check it, and somehow you've distributed yourself to being two agents, and the reason why they're going to believe at the end your proof is because they know that these two agents are not, cannot corroborate their cannot sit in the same room and see what questions you're asking of each other. And in fact, it turns out that these multi-prover proofs have really made a big splash in complexity theory, because they in turn are equivalent to something else, which is called probabilistically checkable proofs, which people are studying till today, which really are sort of these fascinating objects that have led to very surprising consequences, even not only in complexity theory, but actually in algorithms. Okay, so, but that's enough of that. Another place that cryptography has made an impact on complexity theory is when we talk about randomness. So as I mentioned earlier, one of the kind of themes of modern cryptography has been to talk about how to generate pseudo-random bits. So how to generate, even though it's not really random, you start with a few random bits and then you generate a lot more bits that look random. So we call them pseudo-random. And this whole question about how do you generate pseudo-randomness is relevant to cryptography, because you need a lot of, you know, randomness, but it's an expensive resource, so you want to generate them deterministically. But it's also relevant to complexity theory, this whole study of randomness versus pseudo-randomness. And some of the work we've done has actually led, so construction of ways to generate pseudo-random bits has led, again, to new insights into complexity theory, such as the power of randomness, how much randomness you need, and even to showing that certain lower bounds are true.
Earlier in our discussion on the internet, you talked about sort of multi-party issues. So can you talk more about multi-party secure protocols, examples, impact, and scalability issues?
Yes. So multi-party secure protocols, as I said, the setting is the following. You have, let's say, N people, or, you know, sitting on the internet, and each one has a secret input, and they'd like to compute a function on these inputs. So what are some examples? You know, an easy example is, let's think of these inputs as, this is a nice example that people use early on. These are salaries. I think Michael Rabin came up with this example. So they're salaries, and they would like to find out who has the highest salary. Let's say there are two people even. It was me and you, and we'd like to find out who has the higher salary, but we don't want to tell each other what our salaries are. Another example might be there's a set of points, set of values that, you know, I have value and so forth, and we want to find out what the average value is. Another possibility would be that the values, my X, your Y, and so forth, are votes. We're voting in an election. And we'd like to, during the protocol, tally up the votes, but I don't want you to know what my vote is, and you don't want to tell me your vote, and so forth. You know, another example might be what I described before about the banks. So I'm a bank, you're a bank, and so forth. We have portfolios. We don't want to tell each other what we're doing, but we want to find out. But the government wants to know if the whole financial system is at risk. So what these multi-party protocols are going to allow us to do is to exchange messages, electronic messages, so that at the end we can tell, in some sense, the outcome, which is there financial risk or isn't there, but we haven't found out absolutely anything about each other's private data. So multi-party protocols essentially allow N people with N private inputs, okay, to compute any function that they desire, okay, on these inputs, so that in such a way that at the end the function is computed correctly, but the inputs are maintained private. And this will hold as long as more than essentially half the people are honest in this protocol. It can also hold even if less than half the people are honest, but then you need some, I need to talk technically. Forget that. So there is some assurance of the privacy and correctness of your data. It has lots and lots of applications. Now, there is a question of scalability. You mentioned that. So when we talk about two people or four banks or small numbers, right, these protocols are also very efficient and can be utilized without any problem. But if you talk about the internet, so large scale, N is large, then these protocols, their efficiency degrades. And so when we talk about efficiency, what are the measures? Is how many people I have to send messages to? What are the size of these messages? How much time it takes me to compute them? And it turns out that one of the most important scalability issues is how many people I have to communicate with. The size of the messages, computation, those are not serious. But how many people do I have to be engaged in communication with? And this is subject of current work, actually, taking previous protocols and making them scalable so that only each person doesn't have to talk to too many.
Now, what can be done regarding one-time programs and obfuscation?
So everything that I've talked about so far always talks about data, right? So we want to protect the secrecy of data, we want to compute on data, and so forth. But another very important issue that people have been worrying about for years is, what about protecting the secrecy of programs? So what does it even mean to protect the secrecy of programs? So when it's data, it's clear. I have some data, I don't want you to know what it is. However, if I ever showed you the data, now you know it. You can copy it and keep it for yourself. But a program is a different creature. So say there's a program that I wrote, and I want you to be able to run it. You can run it on many inputs, right? You can run it again and again, each time it on different inputs, and you get different answers. But so what does it mean that this program, to maintain some of the privacy or the security of this program? You could give two different definitions. One is that even though you can run my program, it doesn't mean that you can, that you yourself, you know, if I took away the program from you, you could have learned from running it or from looking at it, how to, write this program yourself. So you couldn't sort of reverse engineer it. So this is some, it's called the obfuscation problem. And people have, you know, in the software industry have worried about that for many years. In the gaming industry, you release a game, let's say for Christmas, some computer game, and you don't want people to be able to look at the code and be able to modify your game and then sell it as their own game, okay? Or to figure out, let's say, if it's a game where it should be taking a long time for you to figure out how to win it because you're playing against other people in the internet, you don't want people to be able to reverse engineer and figure out how to win against everyone else. So that's the obfuscation problem. How can you release software and still maintain control over it in the sense that people can't reverse engineer it? The one-time program is the question, or what we call, this is work with Guy Rossum and Yael Kalai, which were students of mine at the time. And what we said is, you know what, it's not another problem. Another problem you could define is, I want to let you have this program, but I only want you to be able to run it once or a limited number of times, and then the program should sort of disappear. You shouldn't be able to run it anymore. So these are two different problems. Obfuscation, I give you the program, you could run it forever, but I don't want you to be able to reverse engineer it. One-time program is, I give you a program, I only want to give you the ability to run it once or a limited number of times, and then it should disappear. So these are fascinating problems. And in fact, the obfuscation problem, one can show that there are some programs for which it's impossible to do, that you could always reverse engineer. But a lot of active work these days is to show classes of programs for which you can obfuscate them. So I can give you the code and you won't be able to reverse engineer it. And in terms of the one-time program type question, if you think about it a little bit, it seems almost impossible to give you a program and only restrict you to run it for a limited amount of time, because you can always copy it, right, and then run it as many times as you like. But so it requires some sort of a physical, something else. So either the program has a little bit of hardware in it, and this hardware in some sense dies off after a certain amount of use, or you can think of this program as being used over the internet. So I give you some code, but in order to run it again and again, you need some piece of information from me. Maybe the program takes a long time, but in order to get it started or to get a meaningful answer from it, you need some token from me. So you need to pull me over the internet and I give you something. And after you've pulled me a certain number of times, I don't give you the token, and therefore you can't run it anymore.
Can you share your thoughts on probabilistically checkable proofs and how they were motivated by cryptographic protocols and have made great impact in complexity proofs?
Yeah, so I kind of started on that earlier. So as I said, you know, interactive proofs can be generalized. You can talk about two-prover proofs. And two-prover proofs are equivalent to something that these days people call probabilistically checkable proofs. So what's a probabilistically checkable proof? What it is the following. It's a way to write proofs, okay? So if you think about proofs, that's just we can take it and write them in another format. Probabilistically checkable proof is a format to write proofs with the following property, that now you do not have to read the entire proof in order to find a bug, if one exists. But it has the property that if the original proof, the classical, you know, textbook kind of proof, had a bug in it, so it was wrong, then when you write it in this new format, it's going to be the case that the mistake is going to show up everywhere or in many locations. So that means now that in order to check this new probabilistically checkable proof, you can probabilistically check a location in the proof. So you check only, you don't read the whole thing, you only check a few locations and which ones you choose at random, and you're guaranteed that if there was a bug anywhere in the original proof, there will be a bug, let's say, you know, in some 30% of the locations you check. So as long as you check more than three locations chosen at random, with good chance you will find one that has a mistake in it. Of course, this 30% and 3 is just an example. So let's say the proof, what you want really to guarantee is that if there was a bug anywhere, then, and with very high probability, you'll find it if you check enough locations. And in fact, what one can show is you only need to check a constant number of locations, regardless of what the size of the original proof was, in order to find a mistake. So that's a probabilistically checkable proof. You probabilistically check it in different locations, and you are sure to find an error with very high probability if one exists. And what it turns out is that this is a way to, so very interestingly, is it, now you can talk about, okay, how should I say it? There's lots of problems, problems from combinatorics, problems from logic, problems from optimization theory, that you can sort of reduce the question of whether this proof has a bug or doesn't have a bug, or any proof in the world has a bug or not, to the question of whether this combinatorial problem or logic problem or whatever problem it is that we are interested in has a solution. And what this reduction means is that now you can say that if you could even approximate the solution of the optimization problem or logic problem you reduced to, then you could find out whether the original proof has a bug or not. And this statement corresponds to essentially saying that it must be hard to approximate this optimization problem. Because if it was easy, then you could tell whether, you know, proofs have bugs or not. I'm getting a little bit too technical, but it's a very strong connection. And these probabilistically checkable proofs have led to showing that certain problems in logic and optimization and combinatorics are very hard even to approximate. Whereas before, we only knew that they were hard to solve exactly.
Can you talk about pseudo-deterministic algorithms?
Yes, a pseudo-deterministic algorithm is something that I'm actually interested in currently. So the idea of pseudo-deterministic algorithm is the following. So it's been known already in complexity theory. People have been talking about probabilistic algorithms for a long time. Since around, I think this is like the late 70s, there's known, well-known algorithms by Solovey-Strassen and Rabin Miller, that they talk about how to use coins, actually tossing coins, in order to solve problems quickly. And so it's an outstanding question is how to take advantage of coin tossing. And in fact, we have a whole bunch of problems where we know how to solve them quickly if we can toss coins, if we can use randomized algorithms, but we don't know how to solve them quickly without randomization. So the question, of course, is it... you know, are these randomized algorithms as good as deterministic algorithms? And, you know, one of the concerns is that when you use a randomized algorithm, it could be that two different times you run it with two different sequences of coins because you're using randomization, you get different answers. So both answers might be good, but they're different. So let's say, an example of a problem that I might want to solve. Let's say I have a map and I want to figure out what's the fastest way to go from one location to another location. And in order to come up with a good solution and a fast solution, I need to toss coins in order to figure out sort of a route. So each time I toss these coins, I might be figuring out a different route. Okay, so both routes might take as much time. You know, when you use, Google Maps or something like that, they give you a bunch of alternatives, right? So think about it that each time you use a Google Map, they give you a different alternative depending on some coin tosses the Google Map is using. So, but in some applications, getting the different answer each time is no good. Okay, so let's say we're trying to coordinate, you know, there's three of us who are going to be driving together. We each use the same program to find out a route through the map, but because the program is tossing coins, we're going to take different routes. And we actually wanted to drive together. I mean, that's sort of a silly example, but you can imagine that if we want to coordinate over the Internet, we'd like to get the same solution when we're running a program rather than different solutions. So pseudo-deterministic, going back to the question, what are pseudo-deterministic algorithms? They're algorithms which are randomized, so they are tossing coins, which helps them maybe to run faster and get better solutions, but they have the guarantee that at the end, even though they're tossing coins, they will come up with the same solution. So they're pseudo-deterministic. That is, they're not deterministic. They're tossing coins, but they look like they are deterministic. Because as far as you can tell, you have no idea what's happening inside the program and the fact that it's tossing coins. All you can tell is if you give it the same input with very high chance, it's going to give the same output. So back to the Google Maps example, we're all going to be driving on the same route, even though we use this program, which was tossing coins and doing these sort of probabilistic calculations. So the question is really, can you do this in general? Can you make every randomized algorithm pseudo-deterministic, so that even though it's using coins, as far as you can tell, it looks like a completely deterministic process.
Now, what are your future research interests?
So I'm very interested in the pseudo-deterministic algorithms, actually, right now. But in terms of the future, another thing, a project that I am engaged in and I'm very interested in is more generally, you know, a lot of the work that we've done is about the power of interaction, right? What more can you do when you interact than you could have done on your own, right? And the power of collaboration. So most of my work asks this question in a cryptographic setting, right? So what is it that you can do? How can you interact? How can you collaborate while maintaining privacy? But these days I'm more interested in this question in a more fundamental sense. That is, why do we interact? You know, why do we collaborate? Apparently, we interact all the time, and we collaborate. You know, I think by and large it's true that some of the best work that people have ever done is through collaboration. So why? Why is this the case? Is there something inherent? Can you sort of couch this problem, ask this question from a computational point of view, and show settings where definitely you can achieve something by collaboration that you couldn't have achieved otherwise? Or you can achieve something by interaction which you absolutely cannot do on your own. So I'm interested in studying this question, sort of try it from a computational point of view. How can you argue, you know, mathematically, you know, give evidence of the fact that collaboration and interaction are absolutely fundamental for making progress?
You know, it's interesting. You discussed your current research interests and your future research interests and also your past work. Can you, again, let's get sort of a broader discussion very quickly. You know, what do you see as the practical applications of this work, past, present, and future?
Practical? I thought everything we talked about was pretty practical. You know, it's enhancing the ability to interact over the internet, to interact remotely, to collaborate remotely. Putting forth, you know, completely new questions, sort of intellectual questions, into the realm of research in theoretical complexity theory or in theoretical computer science. I think that it has sort of, you know, it's the best kind of research, at least from my point of view. It has very clear implications and applications, but it also is sort of intellectually intriguing regardless of what, you know, technological platform we're working with.
Can you describe the types of research being created or updated that will drive our experiences in, let's say, 10 years, and what this experience would be like if you could paint a picture for our audience?
Can you repeat the question?
Yes, I'm thinking from a broader sense now. If you can describe the types of research that you will forecast maybe in the next 5 or 10 years,
okay,
and what the implications of that research would be in 5 or 10 years.
Okay, so I think that, you know, there are three areas that I think are very interesting this in response to your question. So one is actually the question of system security. So one of the biggest issues that people talk about today is, okay, you have wonderful cryptography, you can prove theorems and so forth. How is it possible that still a lot of systems get broken? So the question is how to make systems use, let's say, the power of cryptography, you know, sort of correctly. And this is called the system security. And in a sense, if you think about it, when we worked on cryptography, people had a lot of intuition about how to do it right, but they weren't so, the foundations weren't well developed. So what is it really you're after? How do you define security? And how do you do it? So I think that it would be amazing, I don't know if 10 years is about the right time span, if someone can come up with such a mathematical foundation for, as a basis for security, for system security. That is, what kind of mathematics can be utilized in order to address system security. That is, how really in practice we secure our systems. So that's one, I think, very interesting and important area of research. You know, another thing that people are working on very actively and they will continue is the whole question of quantum computation versus classical computation, which is very important to cryptography. Because if the adversary now, whoever's trying to break, is quantum, then they have access to a very different kind of information than they have now. And the question is whether that should, how is that going to modify how we do cryptography and how we attack cryptography? So I think there'll be more and more questions of this sort. Another example is, you know, whereas when I started this work, we were very careful not to make too many computational assumptions. You know, factoring is hard, or sometimes that seemed to be too much to us, so we try to minimize that more and more. Today, since there's so many more challenges with the explosion of computers, with the explosion of the internet, people want to get more and more abilities, more and more, solve more and more problems that are posed, and therefore they're willing to assume a lot more about hardness of problems. And the question is, how far can that go? You know, how do we trust the kind of assumptions we make? That's I think, very important. And then I guess maybe another area that has been thought of in the past, but I think will be more and more with the scalability question, is, okay, we need these systems to work in practice with large scale, on large scale, right? Lots of users. It's just like the questions about data today, right? The data, let's say the biological data, the genomics data is huge. The data over the internet is huge. So if we want to run algorithms on this data, you know, the old paradigms of running efficient algorithms don't exist anymore because the data or they don't hold up anymore because the data is so large. So we need new methods of computing on large data, which essentially won't touch the whole data, but they will just sample it. And so we have to trade off the correctness we're going to get, since we're not going to look at the entire data. So we're not going to get something that's absolutely correct, but it's sort of approximately correct. And we need to trade off the correctness with how much efficiency we can get. And this trade-off between correctness and efficiency, I think, is a very interesting question that will continue to play out in the next 10 years and more.
This is a somewhat related question. Shafi, you know, you are a giant in the industry. You had a global impact, in fact, and an historical impact, and you've laid many of the foundational pillars due to your pioneering work. Now, distilling from your experiences, if you were to talk to today's youth, what would you say would be the greater burning challenges and research problems to inspire them to get into computing?
I think that, there's so many answers to this question. For example, the last thing they talked about, the fact that the data that's out there is enormous. You know, it's just more and more. And what can we do with this data? So, you know, one question is sort of in some sense you can think of it as an efficiency question or a technical question. And that is, we can do on this data what we used to be doing before, it's just that now we have more data. So the only question is a question of how to do it faster. So before, let's say we had a little bit of a data, we knew how to compute on it. Now we have large amounts, we need to modify the way we compute, sort of, not to get stumped by the fact that the data is so large. But the other question is, we have more data than we ever had. Okay, maybe this, you know, this data can tell us things. You know, they can sort of tell us what to ask. So whereas before we knew what we were asking, and we had algorithms, and now we just have to modify those algorithms to work even when the data is large, you could sort of reverse the question and say, okay, there is this data, and maybe there are completely new questions we can ask given that it's such a large amount of data. So kind of data-driven research. I think that's fascinating. This whole question about, can the data drive what we're going to ask, is a fascinating question, I think, for young researchers. That's one. And from the point of view of cryptography or security, there's that question of how do we take advantage of the fact that we can talk to so many people that we couldn't have talked to before, who know so much more, who have so much more data, and make the world sort of a better place, a more interesting place, a scientifically richer place, to capitalize on that. But in order to do that, we need to have some measure of confidence that by divulging our data or by engaging in computation with other people, we're not kind of destroying our own security. So somehow we need to make it possible to capitalize on all this fantastic new abilities in terms of who we can communicate with and what data we can reach without compromising, you know, sort of our own individual security. And I think, again, that's a fascinating question for someone who wants to get into the field. Question of scalability, question of how to ensure that whatever we can do with this new data can be done securely.
We're now going to get to some of the personal attributes of you because of the fact that you are this historical figure. You've made so many outstanding contributions to so many domains, not just in the computing domain, because the work really expands to many other domains as well. So the first question in the series would be, what specific qualities make you excel and why?
Me? it's hard to tell, right? It's hard to be your own witness. I guess if I had to kind of point out a specific quality, is it persistence. Maybe two qualities. Persistence, so I don't give up so easily. And I believe that that's probably the most important attribute one must have in order to succeed, certainly in research, is to be insistent and not leave it alone. That's one. And I guess the second thing, speaking for myself, is that I'm very, I don't think in a very sort of narrow way. So I don't think in one way. I try to think of a problem from different perspectives and see connections to, let's say, problems I thought about in the past, maybe something that other people are working on. You know, I may go into a lecture which talks about completely different topics and can find something relevant to problems I work on. So it's both these properties, I guess, were useful for me and are probably useful for everybody, not to be too narrow in your thinking, especially today when we are exposed to so much new research in different fields, and to be persistent.
Shafi, you've had this amazing career, and are those any ones that you want to mention that who inspire you in terms of the work that you do, and maybe in the past, present, or perhaps even into the future?
I think that I've had fantastic mentors. I think that when I was a grad student at Berkeley, there was Professor Blum, my advisor, Professor Karp. They were fantastic to have around. They've their questions, their zest for research, their enthusiasm about what they were doing, and their clarity of thinking was priceless for me. Then I have colleagues that I've worked with over the years. There's Aldid Goldreich, which has been co-authored on many works. Mike Sitzer, that just talking to him and his way of thinking and his originality. There's Charlie Rackoff, who was also a co-author of ours on the Zero Knowledge Proof. There's all my students, which I've learned a tremendous amount from. And they are amazing. You know, there's a large number of them, and they have been crucial for my development and for my my love of this field. So I would say that I was inspired by my my mentors, my colleagues, and my students, maybe even more than everyone else. If you are looking for some historical figures, I'm not, that speaks less to me. Who inspired me are people I was in contact with, not people I read about in books. And Rivest also, you know, who was a colleague at MIT. When I came to MIT from Berkeley, it was just an explosion of research and research freedom with Ron Rivest, and again, you know, Goldreich was here, Benny Shore. There was a very active group of researchers who we collaborated with, and which made everything very exciting, and everything happened.
You know, you've had an amazing time in terms of your educational history, for example, at Carnegie Mellon and then at Berkeley, and then at MIT and the Weizmann Institute. Are there any sort of specific challenges or points of interest throughout that sort of educational experience that are perhaps were catalysts to inflection points in your lifetime of contributions?
Yeah, I think being in Carnegie Mellon was, you know, godsend. It was a very exciting time. You know, there are all these greats of the field. You know, I took artificial intelligence with Raj Reddy, and then I took this first algorithms course with John Bentley, and then I took a course in software engineering from Anita Jones, and there are all these people who were just they were tremendous lecturers. They were and they taught me a tremendous amount. And then I had I learned how to program, and I was programming on the CM Star project, which is a multiprocessor project in Carnegie Mellon, and Anita Jones was my supervisor. So I think all of that kind of made me realize how exciting computer science was, and also gave me a chance to do research, which was on this same STAR project. And maybe another catalyst was that Raj Reddy at the time, he gave me, I wanted to do artificial intelligence, and he kind of recommended me for this internship at RAND in Santa Monica, and that was sort of kind of propelled me to go to California, and then made me take the next professional step, which was to go to Berkeley, where I started getting interested in theory. And I met these fantastic advisors and fantastic graduate students who were the theory group at Berkeley. That was, again, another catalyst, sort of switching into theory computation because of the environment, because of the people, and because of the work. And then this course of Manuel Blum, which I mentioned before, where he exposed me to number theory and these questions of coin tossing and how to utilize number theory in order to solve these new problems. So these were certainly catalytic events, even though they're not described as a single event, they kind of cumulatively pushed me ahead.
Now, Shafi, you know, we're at the very last question in this interview, and are there any additional sort of insights that you want to give to the audience regards to your research or your personal life or some of the inspirations in your life or any broader questions or controversies? Any closing comments?
My closing comment is that I think that the work that we were honored for, that we got the Turing Award for, was not traditional at the time. So it wasn't that we were solving some long-standing open problem, which would have been wonderful, but that's not what we did. We kind of followed our excitement. So there were some of these questions of cryptography, which were very new at the time, and we tried to understand what is the real question. How do you really define what you're trying to go after? And we're very liberal, we're very free in coming up with methods to address it. And this freedom enabled us to go far. And one of the conclusions is that allowing yourself not to be restricted by the current rules of science or by the current dogma of which problems to work on and how to solve them it's the right way to go. It certainly was the right way for me. And I would encourage people when they're graduate students, before they have selected their research program, to put some time into thinking what it is that they want to study and what's interesting to them. And that doesn't necessarily have to be what their advisor is doing or what all the other graduate students are doing, but really what they like, and then let themselves have freedom in pursuing it. I think think those are my closing remarks.
Well, Shafi, again, it's been a real pleasure talking with you. You are this historical figure. You continue to make significant research contributions. It resonates throughout the computing community and beyond. And the work has so much implications and impact in so many domains. So I know your schedule is demanding, and we are indeed fortunate to have you come in to do this interview. And thank you for sharing your many deep insights and substantial wisdom with our audience.
Well, thank you very much for having the opportunity.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Professor Shafi Goldwasser, ACM Turing Award recipient in 2013, which is often thought of as the Nobel Prize of Computing. Professor Shafi Goldwasser is also a world-renowned distinguished researcher and professor at MIT in the Weizmann Institute.